Welcome to Feminist Question Time, brought to you by Women's Declaration International, the leading global organisation defending women's sex-based rights against the threats posed by gender identity ideology. There's more information on the website womensdeclaration.com, where you will find our Declaration on Women's Sex-Based Rights, which has been signed by 32,129 people from 159 countries and is supported by 453 organisations. We have over 100 volunteer activists, including 53 country contacts, engaged in defending women's rights. This week, I am delighted to say we have Isabella Calegari from Brazil. She will speak about the naturalisation of oppression, surrogacy, and the postmodern perspective. After Isabella, we have Julia Long from the UK. Her talk is a critique of gender critical feminism. And then joining us will be Kelly J. Keane from the UK, from the organization Standing for Women. And we'll chat to her about the organization, how she is, her activism, and what's next for Standing for Women and for Kelly J. Keane. I'm really pleased now to hand over to our first speaker, who is Isabella Calegari. Isabella is a mother, an economist, and an activist for women's liberation. And her talk today is The Naturalization of Oppression, Surrogacy, and the Postmodern Perspective. So thank you so much, Isabella, and over to you.
The practice of surrogacy is being naturalized and normalized and expanded, both in its commercial mode and also in its altruistic modality, as it is the case here in Brazil. And we are seeing that this is being pushed, this normalization, through the media, as it is the case for rich, famous people, and also through LGBT organizations, which are normalizing this as a kind of extended biological right and the possibility to conformation of non-normative families as they propose. And so in this way of legitimation, we have this postmodern perspective behind it as an academic legitimation. And I will try to pass through this theory briefly today. So this realm of theory that talks about surrogacy comes from this kind of, as it is called, cyborg feminism, channel feminism, and this kind of theories. And they can make a kind of arrangement of some so-called Marxist concepts, which become really misplaced to justify surrogacy as a means to liberation and from actually this new world of non-normative families. And so that is the case of some recent books on this field. So it is curious because this path of theorizing starts from a radical defense of abortion and a radical defense of surrogacy as gestational work, which can be directly put together with this notion of sex work, as it is obvious. And so when we see this kind of radical defense of abortion, it comes from a place where gestation in human species is considered inherently dangerous and risky. So this is the premise, which from my point of view is already a transhumanist perspective, because it is like we as a species, as biological beings, need almost inherently this help from the medical complex and the medical industry. Although this theorists, they also make a praise to the kind of midwifery that we have. So it is a bit contradictory, but as it is made in the work of Preciado, for example, and other queer theorists, it is like everything can be labeled as technology. So from the grassroots kind of work and education that is made to just gestate with minimal medical interventions possible, it is considered a technology. And also this great futurist techno-utopian things is also considered technology. So although in the theory they sometimes make this assumption that women should have access to the best medical care possible with minimal intervention, I think that the way the queer theory frames everything as a kind of technology, it is like they say everything is gender technology, right? So they put everything in the same place. And this puts the feminist critic really, really impossible to be made, because we have always made this critique of the beauty complex, for example, or the beauty industry standards that are put on women. And if this is technology in the same way of, I don't know, gender expression or clothes or things like that, it makes the critic really impossible to be made. So I think the same happens here. It's kind of this step forward in surrogacy, it is considered only one more step forward in everything that is already happening in common pregnancy and birth. Like, it is only one step more of technology. And I think this also eliminates the kind of quality leap that we make from here, because if feminism, midwifery, and so on was already criticizing the cesarean industry, for example, we have to criticize even further the surrogacy, because of not only the interventions in women's body, but everything else that is involved. But these theorists, they put as if feminists were not criticizing motherhood and pregnancy and everything that is involved upon women and this industry, and they are just criticizing from now on because of commercialization, which is definitely not the case. But commercialization puts even further oppression upon women. And also there are some passages where it is put like this dystopian future that feminists alert on this will never happen, since we are seeing on commons here, because it is the view of this line of thought. We are seeing surrogacy happening from a long time and nothing has changed. This is the argument. But in the same book, the author puts that it has changed a lot, because if in the 1980s, surrogacy was mainly done through someone close to you that you knew from work or from workplace or from your neighborhood, now it is transnational and it is handled to people, to wealthier people that are buying lots of babies. So this is not just a quantity issue, it's changing qualitatively also. And if it becomes totally widespread and normalized, it will definitely change the quality of women's life in general, and it will put oppression further on us. There is also this kind of transhumanist thing in all of it, all of this argument, since the baby is seen, including in one book that I am mostly based on, which is Full Surrogacy Now by Sophie Lewis. The baby, the fetus, is seen as a kind of cancer inside the mother, and or a parasite, I don't know, something that is growing inside, but it is not wanted, and it's almost like a disease. And also the baby separation from the mother is considered totally normal and even desirable in this future of a non-normative families, non-nuclear bourgeois heterosexual families. So this separation from the baby is put forward as the whole queer theory is putting forward this disembodiment, this detachment from our bodies and what our body produced in the case of the baby. So it is not just the disembodiment from the uterus or the belly that will be rented, but also the separation from the baby as a commodity, but it is valued as a positive thing, since in this future, women will allegedly find new ways to connect with babies and other women in this kind of trust and help ways that they help one another. And it forgets that it is already happening in this altruistic modality. And the altruism here is definitely not one of true will and heart, since the altruistic comes from our socialization and also from the need to survive once that the altruistic things, it's not really altruistic. Here in Brazil, for example, we know that we have altruistic, but there is this parallel market. So we have also the argument that it is impossible to ban surrogacy. So again, this line of thought that goes directly to what is called sex work, that it is impossible to ban prostitution. So we have to regulate it, which I also think that is contradictory, because banning is a kind of regulation, right? It is also based on law and judicial forces. So if you can regulate in thesis, you could ban it. And then some examples are put on, like Cambodian, which allegedly got the surrogate mothers on jail for it, and they were the persecuted ones. But we know that as the same as for prostitution, the women are not criminalized in our proposals. So this is a fallacy. And there is this allegation that if you do not regulate it, it will definitely grow and at the expense of women and poor women. But I think that as everything on this realm of theory, there is an impossibility put to discuss the very technology process, to discuss the politics of this kind of technology, which feminists, radical feminists were doing since 1980, to discuss technology and the legitimation of the rent of a woman's body to produce a product. This is what should be discussed. But as they only discuss regulation, everything that goes wrong, it's a matter of faulting regulation, or that the law that exists is not being properly, correctly followed. So it's the same as the sex work and commas argument. And then also, I trace the parallel with the gender ideology in many ways, because first, the defense of this comes not only from the place where it is just a work, but also of this place of defense of a bodily autonomy, but that is detached from an oppression analysis. So bodily autonomy is the word that is the expression that is used here to defend abortion and also to defend surrogacy. And this author, for example, defends also the blocking of puberty in children in the same ground. So I think it's very important, the two things here we as feminists have to look is that abortion cannot be defended only in the grounds of bodily autonomy, because I think it is a fragile argument, because it gives base for everything that is, they say it's bodily autonomy. So it has to be attached to a structure of oppression and the analysis of it. Because these authors defend the kind of thing that choice feminism defends, like bodily autonomy is to block puberty, is to prostitute yourself, to be a gestational work, and also to make an abortion. Everything would be bodily autonomy. And also I think we must be careful with this argument of everything is work, that it is kind of tenet to Marxism, and it is very present in this analysis, because of course, when we think of a capitalist production, and this is what feminists have shown with the sex division of labor, that women also produce a merchandise in commons that is essential to capitalist production. And it is in that sense that the authors here are putting gestational work in the way that it produces a merchandise. But we cannot reduce everything to work. I think that the flaw here is that although the things can contain work in the sense that it contains energy and time and things that we put in this productions, it is not reducible to work. Because if it is reducible to work, we will give basis to what is being put forward here. So what is being explained here is that it is only a work and it is only a product. And then they show lots of data on how much this kind of abortion and detachment from the children is not a trauma for many women, most not a trauma, which I don't know about this research, but anyway, it is an anti-feminist perspective because it keeps revolving to the argument also that we have to listen to gestational workers that are kind of organizing itself, which is also not a Marxist approach, because today, if we listen to workers, or if we made a research, a poll on workers, they would definitely mostly not want communism, for example, or not want to abolish the private property. So I don't understand how someone can say that it is a Marxist approach and that you have to only listen to workers and that feminists don't listen to workers. And then you say everything is work, but you are actually reducing everything to work. And also this transhumanist and bodily autonomy approach, these were the main things that I think we should be careful, because they are actually arguments that are present both in Marxism, leftism, and also in feminism, but they are totally misplaced and distorted. And they come to this conclusion that in a utopian society, people will have children for everybody. And this would be the kind of full surrogacy. So this proposes that we listen to these workers in commas, and help them to organize. It includes has some quotations of, cooperatives of these workers that are happening in India, for example, that the workers want to be in kind of a syndicate or a cooperative. And if this is put forward, that's the argument, if this is put forward, then we will come to this place of a common and communist liberated woman that will be available to give the children to, I don't know who, but I think the main thing here also is that it takes from this perspective of work and keeps looking at work and community, like this cooperative, syndicalization and everything. And it never looks to the buyer, which is the same thing as the approach they have on prostitution. You look at the organization of prostitutes and their syndicalization and things like that, but you don't question, in a feminist and even Marxist perspective, if it is legitimate and if it is valid in a utopian society, including, for people to want this kind of service or product, which is a baby in the case. So you are looking at the place of work and to organize and to cooperativize. And the parallel doesn't fit also, because the cooperatives we have that are producing, for example, food, yes, they can be a location where workers will be more, I don't know, they are together and they are producing and they are equally dividing things and they are creating conscious of class. Okay, but they are producing food or products that can be even for themselves or for partners and for poor people, as happens here in Brazil, for example, many cooperatives. But in this case, you are producing babies, so there is no point of this being cooperative or not. And I'm already finishing. So this is kind of the utopia presented. And I think the main points we have to look is this misplacement of Marxism and leftism and even feminism with the kind of bodily autonomy thing. And the last thing is that it also traces a parallel to gender ideology when it completely changes and invert the focus of oppression. So as in gender ideology, the problem starts to be the sex in itself, and people start to look the abolition of sex as if sex was a problem, biology was a problem, and gender becomes reified, and the proposal is to reinvent gender and achieve some kind of utopia through gender and abolishing sex. And here the same is happening. They are trying to propose an abolition of the ways we get pregnant and deliver babies, and some kind of intervention, medical intervention in it, and commercial intervention in it, and reinventing and reification. There is a reification of surrogacy, like if surrogacy was not the problem, but the way that we make babies and biology had to be changed in this future, in this utopian future, through surrogacy. So it is the same. It is like the sex has to be changed, as we're seeing now, and the gender reinvented. The same thing is happening here. The surrogacy is reinvented, and the pregnancy and biology becomes a problem in itself.
If you have published, so we're having some people saying about your economic analysis, and if you have published work that they can, or if your talk today was published, that we can give people the PDF of it. And then also, if you would like to add something that you know, a question that's come up, Isabella.
I haven't yet published this. I am studying this and intend to publish about surrogacy from an economist perspective. But my main references here were this book from Sophie Lewis, Full Surrogacy Now, and also the things that are related to this, which is Dialectic of Sex from Sulamith Firestone, and Cyborg Manifesto from Donna Haraway, which is not directly for about surrogacy, but everything like seems to come from that place of cyborg thing. And from the radical perspective, I have used Renate Klein, Surrogacy, a Human Rights Violation, and Woman as Womb from Janice Raymond. And those were my main references from now. What I would like to add, I have seen in the chat, is the thing about alienation. Someone have asked, like, how come you see this, the person making the argument, right? See this as work, and then pushes it forward in order to liberate us somehow, if by a Marxist perspective, the work is alienated, right? So this argument also comes from the things of xenofeminist. There is also a xenofeminist manifesto, which you can find on the internet, and is really transhumanist and stuff. And this xenofeminist thing is also what we call accelerationist. I don't know how you pronounce it, but it is like acceleration of futures of capitalism and neoliberalism. And the bet is that if you accelerate things, like it is so bad that it, eventually comes good. I don't know, like you can find spaces among the structures and so on. So this is like the leftist accelerationism. It is like a thing that comes from that. And also there was a question about overpopulation, which is the thing that I would like to look from the economist perspective. And here it's very important, and I forgot to mention this because of the time, but my hypothesis, which I intend to look further, as Sophie Lewis, which is this author, says a lot about the myth of overpopulation and how this have been kind of used in a xenophobic way, because actually people talked about overpopulation to sterilize people. That's the argument, okay? But it seems to me that her analysis, it's not a critique of that, but is indeed a defense of demanding babies, like in general. People have the right to demand babies, to make babies, to not, you know, if they are poor, they have the right to make babies. Okay, but if they are rich, they have the right to want babies if they are queer and cannot make anything. That's the point. That's the argument. And so I have this hypothesis, which also links to another question, that we are in truly a civilization crisis, capitalist crisis of huge proportions. And this is being pushed also from the perspective of population control, which is not population control, but population incentivation, because I have seen many leaders, European leaders, Chinese leaders, trying to incentivize people to have more children ineffectively. It is not working. China has now for more than a decade of explicit incentivization of children, more children, and it's not working. People actually don't want more children. So I see this as totally connected with the loss of reproductive rights, the loss of the right of to abortion in the United States. So it seems like two opposite things, like one from the right and one from the left, but both of them are like incentivizing more babies. And this would be necessary in my point of view, because capitalism not only needs poor people working, but also needs consumers. So you need a brutal mass of people, which ones will be explored and will be demonetized. They don't have the money, and other ones will keep the demand side, keep going. So right now we have demand crisis. We have people that are very impoverished. So you don't have enough people to explore and to consume.
We're now going to hear from Dr. Julia Long. So Julia Long is a lesbian feminist with a background in research and campaigning and against male violence, who is now focused on building women's community, growing veggies, and living the revolution now.
What I'm going to be talking about is, I will talk about this term, this whatever this incarnation of feminism called gender critical feminism, but I'm mainly going to be looking at that through a focus on Holly Lawford Smith's book of the same name, Gender Critical Feminism. There's a few reasons for that. Firstly, because I have already done a talk some time ago where I was talking kind of, you know, fairly generally about what I think are some of the problems and issues with gender critical feminism. So I didn't just want to repeat that. And also because I think the publication of Holly's book is obviously very significant in that it it's going to have a far, you know, it's going to have quite a far wide reach, far and wide reach. It's published by Oxford University Press, so it's going to be, you know, going into all the sort of academic institutions, and I think it's going to be seen as a very authoritative account, and so therefore I think it's definitely worth engaging with her main kind of premise and arguments there. I know that Holly has also spoken about the book on one of the Radical Feminist Perspective sessions, along with Caroline Norma and with Jo. So I think that's really good that she did that. And I very much hope that this, what I'm going to say here, is taken in the spirit of a dialogue and also as a way of building on analysis kind of across the board from a radical feminist perspective, and also maybe, you know, building from some of what Holly does in the book. I am going to be making some, you know, quite serious critical points about what I think are the problems with kind of broadly the politics of the book, because I do think there are substantial problems with that, but it's very much in the spirit of looking at what those politics are and where we can go with that in terms of a dialogue and sort of going forward. But anyway, before I do any of that, I actually wanted to start by talking a little bit about radical feminism, partly because I suppose one of the main things that Holly does with that book is to assert gender critical feminism as some kind of successor to radical feminism. She certainly speaks about radical feminism in the past tense a lot in the book, and talks about gender critical feminism, you know, in language like, you know, the latest incarnation of radical feminism, that kind of thing. So I did want to begin with a focus on radical feminism, not least because this particular week has particular significance for me, because it's the 10-year anniversary since the Radical Feminist Conference, RadFem 2012, which took place sort of in the middle of July of 2012, and which I was very much involved in organising and participating in. And I think, if I may say so, I think that actually was quite a significant contribution to the development of radical feminist politics in the United Kingdom at the time. And it was part of a much broader resurgence of radical feminism across the board. And I think around about the same time, there was another radical feminist conference called, I think it was the RadFem Reboot, I think was the one happening in the United States, like within a week or two of each other. And there were other conferences that also went on in the United States and in Australia at the same time. And then there were a number of conferences in the following years in the UK, including RadFem 2013, FemiFest, RadFems Resist, a small conference on radical feminist perspectives on transgenderism in 2014, the much bigger Thinking Differently conference. And actually, again, speaking of anniversaries, it's the sixth anniversary of that conference today. It was Saturday, the 16th of July, 2016. There was an Andrea Dworkin conference in 2015, and there were a number of European women's gatherings from around about 2016 onwards. So anyway, I'm rattling through all of those just to say that radical feminism, I think, is very much alive. And I think the Women's Declaration International and sort of related projects and initiatives are very much indicative of that. Alongside this, you know, this kind of, I guess, flourishing of all these different conferences and events, there has also been ongoing publications, very, very significantly, obviously, of Sheila Jeffrey's work, Gender Hurts, in 2014, which I think is, you know, extremely foundational, definitely highly influential in terms of the current, what's become the gender critical movement. Publications of things like Gail Dines' Pornland and all the publications by Spinifex Press, which I can't sort of list here, but my little iPad is perched on one of them here, the Not Dead Yet, which I think is a very, very well chosen title for the book that came out last year from Spinifex. And I think it's particularly particularly relevant in terms of thinking about some of Holly's claims and arguments in her book. But basically to say that radical feminism is obviously an ongoing movement, and I think that's really important. Crucial, in fact, and I think that's one of the things that probably a few of us have taken issue with regarding Holly's book. So I wanted to start off by talking a bit about the politics of the book and what the book does politically, whether it's what Holly necessarily intended to achieve or not. I think this is what it achieves politically, and what I think is to say the least, problematic. So she very much asserts in the book that she asserts the salience and importance and relevance of this movement that she calls gender critical feminism as basically the way forward for feminism. And I'm going to quote what she says in the preface. So she says, "I wrote this book because I think gender critical feminism presents the greatest challenge to conservative or traditionalist views about gender and has the best chance of overturning it. I think it is more ambitious and significantly more appealing and coherent than the alternative heterodox view of sex slash gender. Contemporary feminism." And by this, when she talks about contemporary feminism, what she's saying here is that what we would all recognise as the kind of choice feminism, or, well, actually, I think it'd be more accurate just to call it anti-feminism. But anyway, it seems to have managed to use this term feminism quite successfully. But the kind of usual trans women are women, sex workers work, choice feminism. Anyway, she says contemporary feminism is kind, inclusive and affirming of women's choices, whatever they happen to be. Those traits have value, but they will not overturn thousands of years of oppression on the basis of oppression on the basis of sex or earn women their liberation. I hope to persuade you that gender critical feminism is the theory and movement that we need. So that's where she's setting out her stall for what she wants to argue and achieve with the book. But I think what she does there is really, really important to pay attention to, because she's basically saying that you've got these conservative views of gender, conservative or traditionalist views. And then on the other side, you've either got the sort of choice feminism, trans women are women type, you know, anti-feminism, I would say, or you've got what she is asserting in terms of gender critical feminism. But obviously what's missing there is radical feminism. And I think the fact that she supplants radical feminism with gender critical feminism is a huge, huge problem. And I'm going to focus, if I don't run out of time, because I've got a lot of material here, I want to focus on a couple of specific points in the book that I think really illustrate how much of a problem that is. So she makes this case of gender critical feminism as being the way forward. So what has happened to radical feminism in her in her kind of framing? Like, where is it? Well, later on, she does talk about gender critical feminism as I think she says, the revival of radical feminism. But what I think is so problematic about that is that some of the claims that she makes and some of the things that she asserts around gender critical feminism simply are at odds with radical feminism and actually don't in any way reflect a radical feminist analysis. So and I think also she doesn't really make a case or make an argument that gender critical feminism has sort of supersedes radical feminism. She tends to assert it as a given that this is the case and this is where we are, which I think does a huge disservice to radical feminism. She doesn't really engage with that and make the argument in the way that she engages with the what we could misname as choice feminism, which I would just say is straightforward anti-feminism. She actually gives the sort of respect to that movement by really engaging with the arguments and trying to refute them and say why gender critical feminism is better in a way that I don't think she does, or she certainly doesn't do consistently with radical feminism. So I think what the book actually, the politics of the book, what it achieves politically, I think is very, very serious, and I think very, very damaging actually in terms of the way that she kind of consigns radical feminism to the past. And I was thinking that if I was going to, and I'm not saying she's doing this intentionally at all, but if I was going to set out to undermine a political movement, I think what I wouldn't do is write a book about it that that really engages with its ideas and arguing why it's wrong, or you know, that kind of thing, because actually that in some ways might actually just give more impetus to it, or maybe serve to validate it in some way. But I think probably what I would do if I really wanted to undermine a movement, I would perhaps pay homage to some of its early thinkers and scholars, and Holly definitely does that in this book. There's, you know, I think probably one of the strongest, or maybe the strongest part is the early section where she really does engage with some of the early radical feminist thinkers. But I think I would constantly refer to it in the past tense. I think I would kind of assert and assume its demise rather than argue for it. I would assert and assume that it's been replaced by another movement. I would probably use phrases about this other movement to suggest that it's the latest incarnation of the movement that I want to undermine. I would fail to engage with its current actors, in terms of groups and individuals. I would probably completely erase some of the very key texts of that movement that are addressing some of the most crucial questions today, such as in this case, I think things like gender hurts. I think she does briefly refer to the transsexual empire. And maybe I would also erase some of the other really fundamental work on language. And I think that I would misrepresent the movement that I want to, I would misrepresent the movement that I want to champion as being consistent with the movement that I want to undermine, suggesting that it's a kind of natural successor. And I think in doing that, whether intentional or not, I think that those kind of strategies, which I see her doing in the book, seriously actually undermines radical feminism as a movement, which I think is a really, really serious problem of the book. As I say, even though I have no doubt that Holly was writing with the best of intentions, and there is definitely, you know, some pretty impressive scholarship in the book as well. But overall, I think that what the book does is consign radical feminism to the past and suggest that it's all been replaced by what I don't think at all is a revival of radical feminism. I don't think gender critical feminism is that. And I think it's particularly problematic given that it's been a book that has been produced within sort of, you know, I know Holly works, you know, within an academic context. So it was published by the Oxford University Press. It's going to, you know, reach into the academic libraries, into the syllabuses, etc. And I think it's going to, like, we know already that within academic settings, radical feminism has in large part already been pretty much eradicated or misrepresented or eliminated, and the key texts don't get onto the onto reading lists, etc. So I think that this, as it is at the moment, the publication of this book is a really serious problem, or the politics of that book is a really serious problem. I do think that the work on the early radical feminist thinkers is valuable, but I think the problem is that it's all spoken about as being in the past. And I'm going to talk a little bit about one of the sections where she talks about what gender critical feminism leaves behind in terms of radical feminist ideas. So I'm going to start then by talking a bit about what I think is one of the main problems of the book, certainly from my perspective. I know that Holly was writing in the Australian context. I think she's at the University of Melbourne. I'm very much looking from a English, British, UK context. And one of the things that I found really a problem about the book is that her assertion that gender critical feminism is this kind of natural successor of radical feminism and it comes out of radical feminism, from what I can see, it just does not map onto the UK situation at all. If we look at some of the main groups and dominant voices in the UK context, you know, groups like obviously Women's Place UK, Fair Play for Women, some of the others, the voices like, you know, those who've written books like Helen Joyce, Kathleen Stock, etc. These groups and individuals definitely aren't coming from a radical feminist politics or political background. They're coming, you know, sometimes they're coming from socialist feminist backgrounds. Sometimes they're coming, are still very much involved with socialist feminism. Sometimes I think they're coming from a more kind of classical sort of liberal type background. Some of the groups, I would say, seem to me to be coming from quite an apolitical background, but are just concerned about, you know, maybe have been sort of mobilised because of the threat to women's rights and women's spaces, etc. I do want to mention, I've got it on gallery view, so I can see Kelly J there. I do want to mention Standing for Women here, and I'm sure Kelly J will be speaking about her coining of what I think is a rather brilliant term of feminism, which sets one of the many things, I guess, which sets that particular group, Standing for Women, apart from some of the others. But certainly, so I'm not really talking about Standing for Women here. I'm definitely not talking about Women's Declaration or Lesbian Rights Alliance or Get the L Out, which we can see are very much part of a radical feminist tradition. But in terms of some of the main voices now that are associated with this term gender critical feminism, I really don't think that this idea that it's come from radical feminism maps on to the picture at all. Maybe I do think that radical feminism, because you know, some of that early work by radical feminists has certainly, I think, served as a kind of galvanizing factor for some of these groups. You could certainly see the influence of radical feminism there, but certainly they're not coming from a radical feminist tradition, and they don't follow radical feminist kind of principles and analysis. So that's one thing that I think is, I just don't think it works. I don't think it kind of maps on in that way. So again, oops, I've lost some balance of my prop from my talk. So one of the reasons why, several of the reasons why I think Holly's analysis doesn't map onto the UK situation is if we see, some of what I think are the kind of key features of this gender critical feminism in the UK, we can see that they're really at odds with radical feminism. They're really at odds with our understanding of women as a sex class or a sex class, and our understanding of patriarchy, our understanding of gender, etc. So I'm just going to briefly go through what I think are the some of the really sort of identifying features of gender critical feminism. And I think it speaks for itself as to why they haven't, this hasn't come from radical feminism. So first of all, in the UK, most of the groups, like some of the ones I've mentioned, and most of the kind of what I might call mainstream gender critical groups, are not fundamentally opposed to transgenderism. They're not. Most of them kind of were set up in terms of the consultation about the reform of the Gender Recognition Act. And they made a case as to being opposed to what was originally called, I think, self-declaration, and then became called self-ID, self-identification of so-called gender. They didn't seek the repeal of the Gender Recognition Act. And they talk about, they used words like they're opposed to the extreme gender identity movement. So they're not, and again, this is where Standing for Women is obviously very much sort of at odds again, also with these gender critical groups. So obviously as radical feminists, we are completely opposed. I'm not going to go into all the reasons why, I think it's perfectly obvious, but we understand transgenderism as a manifestation of patriarchal oppression of women. We don't kind of make any caveats or any exceptions for that. It's completely clear. So I think that's one of the really early ways where they parted company with us. We also don't actually believe that transgenderism is a thing. We understand it as a patriarchal ideology, but we don't think there's such a thing as a trans person, a trans child, a trans woman, that there's such a thing as transphobia. So we are not going to qualify anything we say by starting off by saying I'm not transphobic or I support transgender rights, which a lot of the gender critical movement movement does, and the kind of thing that Holly does also in this book. I'm gonna have to, even though I know you've given me lots of time, Joe, I'm going to have to cut some of this out. So I'll just kind of list some of these things, I think, because I think we can maybe talk about them a bit more in the chat. And they've probably been really well rehearsed in this context anyway. So obviously, we radical feminists have no truck with this notion of true trans, which, again, I think is also a euphemism, because it's actually used as a kind of another Trojan horse to allow men to come and speak as some version of not being men, whether that's as a transsexual or a trans woman without the space between the two words, you know, this kind of thing. So, but the gender critical groups and individuals very much, and we can see this in their work, in their events, in their contributions on social media, we can see that they make this exception about men, which actually means that what they do is that they shoehorn men into the arena as supposed allies and spokespeople for our movement. Another thing that some of the gender critical feminist groups are, or they, you know, what their politics is about a very strong affiliation with the left, and about prioritizing men on the left. And I think they've been so concerned to try and win over their male, I don't know what we call them, male companions or male antagonists, whoever, on the left, is that they prioritise that over their responsibility to not gaslight women. I think that's one of the things that I've seen over and over again. So they will use language that placates men on the left at the expense of not being completely honest and truthful and straightforward with other women. Very briefly, I know I've said a number of times before, I think the term itself, gender critical feminism, is clearly not reflective of a radical feminist politics, because we would not say that we are critical of gender. We would say that we thoroughly reject gender, or that we are gender abolitionists. I don't think any one of us would use the term patriarchy critical. So why would we use the term gender critical? As Leah Keith observed recently, we wouldn't say slavery critical. So I think the fact that term is used by these groups and individuals is in itself illustrative of their distance, political distance from us. And also, as I've observed before, I find that much of what comes under the rubric of gender critical feminism actually isn't even really that critical of gender in terms of the radical feminist analysis of femininity, of heterosexuality, of, you know, this kind of broad issues around gender. That is not really to be found, and it's certainly something I think that gets also erased in Holly's book. So I think there were, for all of these reasons, it doesn't her argument that gender critical feminism comes from radical feminism or is a natural successor to it doesn't really work. I haven't got time to go into this particularly, but I did just want to mention, obviously in recent days, weeks, there's been a lot of talk from the gender critical groups about, once again, about this creating a narrative about working with the right, all these dangers about working with the right. I don't remember Holly, I think Holly does talk about this a bit in her book, I just wanted to address some of the things that have been that I think are sort of going around at the moment in terms of UK gender critical feminism. It seems to me, from what I've seen of some of this stuff, and I haven't necessarily seen all of it, but I think what is being done is that there's this kind of spectre that's being created that is trying to create kind of quite an extended fear of association with, I don't know, probably with certain individuals or certain groups, because of these dangers of working with the right, so to speak, and who these groups are and what, you know, what they're about and how dangerous they are for for women, for women's rights. Now, I'm not going to talk about the US context, but I will talk about the UK context. And I've really got all of this endless kind of verbiage about it is really making me ask three questions. For a start, I'm not even going to talk about the rights or wrongs of it, but I'm just going to ask, for a start, all of this verbiage around how terrible it is to work with the right and how dangerous these groups are, I wonder who is actually working with the right in this way that is kind of being set up as given. Like, if these groups are, which I really haven't seen any evidence, I don't even know quite who is being referred to here. Like, if they are, what does this involve, and how is any kind of this kind of an alliance or supposed alliance, what is actually happening, and how is it actually promoting anti-woman interests? Because I think they're very short on saying that, but what they're very strong on doing is kind of whipping up a kind of a scaremongering type thing. There's another bit there that I'm just going to have to skip. And also, I wonder, when there is all of this rhetoric going on about not working with the right, I wonder, why is it not okay to work with those who in some cases do seek to end women's right to abortion? Why is it not okay to work with those groups, but it is okay to work with those on the left who seek to end women's rights full stop? Why is one okay and not the other? I don't understand that. And then finally, why is it okay to be very emphatic in vocally opposing patriarchal right-wing agenda when it comes from Christian doctrine and practices, but not when it comes from other religious doctrine and practices? Again, I just think there's a real inconsistency there. And it seems to me that also what goes along with all this rhetoric around this work, so-called working with the right, what I think kind of gets elided in that are some of the real problems of gender critical feminism in terms of championing so-called, transsexuals as being, trans women, and some of this kind of stuff. And also what goes along with it is a very thoroughgoing demonization and vilification and personal attacks on individual women, not least some of the company here, as we all know. And I think that isn't just about, I don't think that's just about sort of personalities or personal motivations. I think there's a very clear politics behind behind some of that. And I think it's about a political will to dominate a terrain and to suppress other voices. So anyway, I did just want to say something about that. I do also want to mention some of the achievements of gender critical feminism, because clearly what comes under this broad banner of gender critical feminism, I've talked a bit about things I really don't agree with about it, but undoubtedly there have been some very successful campaigns, and particularly some successful legal cases, which I think would all kind of come under this term of gender critical feminism. And not least, maybe one to pull out from that, is the Maya Forstater ruling that gender critical beliefs, even though obviously recognizing that there are two sexes isn't really a belief of any kind, or it's just a kind of statement of the bleeding obvious, as Basil Fawlty might have said. I think the ruling that gender critical beliefs are worthy of respect in a democratic society is something that is absolutely invaluable, and it's invaluable to many of us in our workplaces and in other contexts. That is really important. And the fact that there were findings of discrimination against Maya Forstater because she held those beliefs, I think is again hugely important. So I'm really, you know, I don't want to underplay any of these big achievements, and there are sort of, you know, plenty of others as well. But I do think there are some really serious issues with the politics of gender critical feminism. Right, Joe, if I take about another 10 minutes, is that okay?
Yes, that's fine. And then we'll get everybody on. We might run over a little bit. And thanks so much, Kelly J, for coming and waiting for this, because we've changed the time. But yeah, that's OK.
OK, so I wanted to just sort of focus in on a couple of parts of the book, which I hope are illustrative of the problems of Holly's claim that gender critical feminism is in some ways a kind of a natural successor or a part of a revival of radical feminism. Because if we look at the section titled something like the idea, radical feminist ideas that gender critical feminism leaves behind, I want to look at what she says there about the ideas around the politics of lesbianism and the politics of separatism. So if we hold in our minds that what she's saying is that basically radical feminism is no more, and we've now got this thing called gender critical feminism, let's have a look at what she says here about lesbianism. She says, gender critical feminism is supportive of lesbianism, but it has no commitments that make it unacceptable or a betrayal for women to have sexual or romantic relationships with men. So she kind of frames it as, in a way, a bit of a kind of choice feminist issue. You know, gender critical feminism is supportive, but it's not interested in saying that it's kind of unacceptable or a betrayal. I'm not particularly interested in getting into ideas or arguments around unacceptability or betrayal. What I am really interested in is the radical feminist analysis of heterosexuality and the radical feminist analysis of, I don't think she particularly talks about it here, of femininity and gender. But if we just stick to the radical feminist political critique of heterosexuality, obviously there's a huge amount of work that's been done here. Where's the bit, what did she say about political lesbianism? She says something like, all she has to say about political lesbianism is that there is an internal disagreement over the moral status of political lesbianism, with some vehemently rejecting the idea that it is possible for a woman to choose to be a lesbian. That's, as far as I can see, that's all she says about it. And she also talks about the radical feminist analysis of heterosexuality, or sort of, you know, the politics of lesbianism as an alternative, is problematic because it alienates too many women from feminism. So she basically wipes out the critique of heterosexuality, the importance of that critique, and the crucial insight of radical feminists that there's nothing inevitable about heterosexuality, and any woman can be a lesbian. She just dismisses that. And I think in particular, again, maybe if I'm sure Sheila has some contributions to make to this in the chat, but what we've seen, you know, particularly with the Korean feminists and others, is a huge revival of interest in lesbianism, lesbian feminism, political lesbianism. And so if Holly is saying that gender critical feminism is replacing radical feminism, she's basically totally eliminating one of the most crucial aspects of radical feminism in doing that, which is another reason why it's a big problem. Similarly, I won't go into the section on separatism. I guess it's kind of parallel, but I will go into it, even though I'm pushed for time, because I think it's really, really important. So she says, again, in a sort of similar vein, gender critical feminism is also not separatist. Is also not separatist more generally when it comes to feminist theory of activism. Gender critical feminists will generally work with men and appreciate the support of male allies. And she says that gender critical feminist isn't separatist in what she says in the strong sense, in the way that maybe a lot of us here understand it, but gender critical feminists value female sex separated spaces, which means that separation from men is a commitment, just in a much more limited number of domains. Well, I'm sorry, Holly, but really, what gives you the right to assert that we're suddenly now only concerned with sex separated spaces in limited domains? I absolutely refute that. And there's ongoing work, political movement, ongoing politics of separatism, of political lesbianism, of lesbian feminism. You know, there's plenty of evidence of that, and I think the fact that you just basically cast it aside like that, I actually think what she's saying here is one of the things that is very accurate about gender critical feminism, because that is also what the gender critical groups here do as well. They just champion sex separated spaces for things like, you know, refugees or, you know, sports and things like that, but they don't have the wider understanding of and commitment to women-only organizing, women-only living, a commitment to separatism as a really crucial aspect of women's liberation. She just basically does away with that, which is, again, I think a really huge problem with the book. I know I'm pretty much coming up to time. I'm going to have to cut a load of this out. I thought I had just about enough for 40 minutes, but I've got enough for about 40 days. I just want to say, in her chapter on transgenderism, I thought a lot of this did actually remind me of Kathleen Stock's book, in that I think because she really seriously misrepresents, or she asserts that gender critical feminism is not anti-trans. She says that. So again, I think that's probably true. Gender critical feminism isn't anti-trans, but in that way, don't try to replace radical feminism with gender critical feminism, because we absolutely are completely opposed to transgenderism, as we are opposed to pornography, prostitution, as we're opposed to any form of men's oppression of women. And so she goes on from there. I mean, I just highlighted so many parts of that section. I just found her arguments there really really kind of pointless, and this sort of endless reasoning about transgenderism and about inclusion of men in women's spaces. It was completely pointless, because I felt that she just fell at the first hurdle, because a women-only space does not have men, full stop. That's non-negotiable. You don't have to make any argument about it. And she says that labeling gender critical feminism as anti-trans is anti-feminist propaganda and the distortion of a movement and theory for women's sex-based rights by labeling it according to what it is not, what it is not about. But we don't say that about anti-pornography, about anti-racism. I think it's I think there's just this real kind of squeamishness about kind of taking the bull by the horns and naming men as men. We see that sort of right the way through, and it's particularly evident, I think, in that chapter. I haven't come on to the manifesto that she gives at the end, and I know that I'm out of time, but maybe that's something that we can return to in the chat, because I'm sure others will have views on that. Sorry, I skipped a lot, so I hope it was more or less coherent. But from my perspective, the radical feminist analysis of compulsory heterosexuality and compulsory femininity is about looking at what those, like what that means in the context of a patriarchal society and the harms of both of those things. That's what it's about. I'm not interested in using those critiques to try to set up some kind of league table in terms of who's a real feminist or who isn't. I'm really not interested in that. I think that's a really kind of pointless exercise, but let's not underestimate the pressures on, and particularly thinking about young women now, the pressures on young women to be heterosexual, whether that's, via the route of femininity or, the transgenderism kind of forcing them into a different path. But we've got men now saying they're lesbian. So it's like either way, you can't really escape it. And let's think about the analysis of heterosexuality by Andrea Dworkin, and certainly more recent ones as well. Let's think about the norms that are being established by pornography in terms of what young women are expected to endure through processes of heterosexuality. Let's not underestimate all of those harms and all of that pressure on young women, both in terms of that compulsory heterosexuality and also in terms of the harms of femininity and that feeling of the unfreedom of your body that compulsory femininity creates. So that's what it's about. It's not about establishing some kind of league table, but what I would say to heterosexual women or to women who, great fans of femininity, whatever, if you're not interested in that, then at the very least, and I'm not saying Kelly J does this for a moment, but definitely other women have, then if you're not interested in any of that analysis, then at least get out of our way, because we have to speak to other women, and there will be some women for whom that is very, very salient, and it could actually be potentially quite life-saving. So I think that's what I want to say about that. And I also want to say that I totally echo what everyone said about the Standing for Women campaigns, and also include with that the kind of research. We haven't really talked about that, but some of the whole kind, all of the other academic scholarship that has gone on in terms of this particular campaigning, whatever movement. I just also want to say that I think it's not, women's liberation isn't just about campaigns. It's also, this is why I wanted to use this phrase about living the revolution now. I think there's a lot that we can do here and now. It's like Mary Daly talked about the foreground and the background. There's a lot that we can do here and now to enjoy those freedoms that we have and to expand them just by living the lives that we want to live. And that's what I think is really important. We don't have to ask men. This is where I parted company with Holly's list at the end, which seemed to me a lot about asking men for things, an end to this and more of this and less of that. We can do not all of this in every situation, but there's a lot that those of us with certain access to certain economic resources and freedoms, there's a lot that we can do. I enjoy women in only space all the time. I don't have to ask any man's permission for that. I don't have to kind of request it. I don't have to argue to keep men out of those. We just get on and do it. The same with rejecting femininity, the same with all kinds of things that I think we can do. And it, so for me, it is very much about just who we are, the lives we want to live. If we want something, I remember it said at the last Mishfest that I attended, if you want something, then create it and then defend it come hell or high water. And there's all kinds of things that we can do within that that doesn't necessarily sit under a campaign or scholarship or kind of activism, but just in terms of living the lives that we want to live.
So Kelly J. Keen, aka Posy Parker, is the founder of Standing for Women, a global women's rights campaign group. She is a woman, a mother of four and a free speech advocate. She first came into the public eye when interviewed under caution by the British police for speaking out about the transitioning of children on Twitter, and is famous for her adult human female t-shirts. Kelly J. Keene's YouTube channel has 53,000 subscribers, and a recent clip of her quip, "I'm not a vet, but I know what a dog is," got 25.5 million views on TikTok. And I've made this together and put it ready for today about 4 days ago. And since then, since 4 days ago, Kelly J has started phone-ins on her YouTube channel, which is just fantastic. It's so creative. It's absolutely brilliant. And it's so obviously the right thing to do to have these phone-ins. It's just brilliant. And I mean, just every week, Kelly J is coming up with new fantastic ideas. And then there's this idea of feminism, which is, again, very, very interesting. Now, so Kelly J is going to give a talk, a short talk, and then there will be space for questions. Put questions in the Q&A, and then we'll get Kelly J to answer some of the questions. You have space, and then also get Julia and Isabella on to have a bit of a chat. So thank you so much for coming, Kelly J, and over to you.
Well, Julia's here, and also Sheila is in the chat. It's thanks to their perspectives that I was able to really get to grips with this issue very, very early on. And I'm absolutely privileged to consider both of those women my friends. But along with Venice Allen, Julie and I went for a trip that we paid for. It wasn't with Nazi gold after all. And we went to Washington to meet up with some of the other women in the chat, Leah Keith and Cara Dansky. And we sort of formed our friendships there. And it was on that trip that Julia really managed to sink much of her perspective into my tiny brain, and it stayed forevermore. And Julia is responsible for convincing Brendan O'Neill not to use the euphemistically, ridiculously called preferred pronouns, or what I might just call straight up lies. And then prior to meeting women like Julia, I was really lucky to be on Mumsnet and meeting a woman called Dittany, who very similarly didn't suffer fools and was able to speak really, really truthful. And I think the truth is a fundamental kind of underpinning of everything that I do. That's not to say that I'm completely flawless when it comes to being really, really honest, often with myself, but just that truthful people, irrespective of what their point of view, are people that I'm drawn to over and above people that repeat the same things that I want to hear. And so that's where the whole woman, adult, human, female comes. That's how it's really quite so easy to speak very plainly and directly, because I'm actually speaking the truth. And I think when we talk about gender critical, even as an expression, number one, I think gender is the most ridiculous word that I can't even tell you what it means, besides a lot of things to a lot of people, and not all of those people will think exactly the same thing about this word. But also when it comes to sex roles and sex stereotypes, I think they're much more useful. And I can't honestly say that I reject all the ones thrown at women as I sit here with a face full of makeup, acrylic nails and an underwired bra. I'm quite happy for some of the sex stereotypes, and that doesn't come from an analytical place at all. It just means it works for me on a daily basis. And it probably means that I am a traitor to my female sex class after all. But I'm happy to say, when it comes to the sex stereotypes of women and the things that I'm routinely, roundly, often criticized by other women who call themselves feminists, it is my least kind of feminine qualities, if you like. It is the fact that I speak directly. It is the fact that I speak plainly. It is the fact that I'm not particularly kind. I don't really care what you think of me. I don't particularly care what they think of me either. And I think this means that I am not remotely stuck in some sort of feminine, submissive role, despite the fact that I also stayed at home with my children, despite the fact that I was weirdly called a housewife. I don't remember doing any housework during those years. But all of those things, it's completely ironic that the women who call themselves feminist, who put it in their bios, who maybe even craft their entire profession around this particular word, will act in a way that is really routinely very unfeminist when it comes to their criticisms of me and whether or not I dye my hair, and also the way that I behave. And then it comes, then I come, I'm going to come on to the right. I don't care how a woman votes. I don't care what her political beliefs are. I don't care. As far as I'm concerned, when I'm fighting for women's rights, which I feel is a lofty term for what it is that I do, which is just stand and speak the truth. But when I speak on behalf of myself, hopefully to other women, I am speaking to all women. I saw somebody in the chat today, which I think, shame on you, frankly, is that she said, I will not fight for women on the right. Well, I will. And there is absolutely nothing that anybody can do that will make me think that that is not a good thing. Because even if I was the most dyed-in-the-wool lefty, which I'm not anymore, but even if I was, I would still want to protect women above, over and above any single one of my political beliefs or their political beliefs. I simply don't understand this division that is man-made. And I mean man in the way like man, penis man. It's a man-made division that only serves against women. It doesn't help any of us to decide that before we are women, we are something else, some other allegiance, some other political persuasion. And often at these, at the top of these pyramids of political persuasion are men benefiting from it. So I just simply don't get why any woman would work against other women in that way. So I don't care about working with the right. I would take money from the devil himself if it meant that we didn't actually mutilate another child, or we didn't shut another woman's space, or we didn't exclude another woman from public or even private sometimes life on the basis of allowing men in those spaces and within those groups. For example, on Facebook, there are endometriosis groups, or there are even stillbirth groups where there are fetishy AGPs in those spaces pretending to be women. So until that stops, I don't stop. And I hope it means that all women, on the basis that I'm a nobody, I'm just an ordinary person, which then makes me sound like I think I'm extraordinary by telling you that I'm ordinary. But I'm just like a regular, normal woman, like anybody else who just said, well, actually, I'm not going to have it. I didn't do it by committee. I didn't do it by collaboration. I'm not asking for permission. I just decided that I wanted to do something and I am doing it. And I implore any single one of you with any grave criticisms about what it is that I do, who I speak to, how I work, you are more than welcome to eclipse me or just do your own small thing and forget that I completely exist and do your own work. I think that is the best way to shut me up and stop me doing anything. So what I've decided to do is to have a non-hierarchical kind of place in which women can gather. And that is our Speaker's Corner events. And they are phenomenal. And anyone can speak about anything they like. And we do say women first. Some men do come along and they are more than welcome. I feel that this is our movement. It annoys me. In the free speech movement, there's barely a woman in it. And so I do feel that this is our movement, whatever it is. I'm happy just to call it a women's movement, to be quite honest, because I think that encompasses everything. And then I do now Turf Talk Tuesdays, which is a phone-in. And, you know, we had a woman who's just left the NHS after 20 years and she rang and spoke. She's a lesbian and she just watched LGBT, which we all know to be T, right? She's just watched this pride movement, this male-dominated movement, just come in and totally gaslight the entire institution of the NHS, and she's finally had enough. We also got a woman who'd been in care, who worries about what's happening to children in care. And these are just, there's something really quite magical about listening to ordinary people, heartfelt, tell you, tell me, tell all of us just what is happening in their lives. And I think that is far more powerful. And I've been to some of these talks, I'm sure you all have, where there are sort of celebrated pedestal women sat at the front and everybody sort of has to sit and listen. Well, that isn't something that I particularly enjoy going to, which is why it's great that this chat is so lively. I don't particularly enjoy going to those sort of very stuffy events. And I think women like to be talked to, not at, and talked with and spoken with and collaborated with, so that they feel that they own part of this movement. And that's why I don't really care whether it's called gender critical. I think that's a real bizarre name, but I understand where it comes from, because it's not radical feminism. It doesn't remotely stand up to scrutiny, as Julia's just talked about. And who am I to talk about it? I've barely got any qualifications at all as a woman, let alone as a radical feminist. But when it comes to any of this, I think a woman's movement is what it is. And that is the biggest qualifier. That's why we came up with feminism at Standing for Women, because it simply was just understanding what a female is and being able to put us first. Because all too often in whatever movement, whether it's anti-racism, whether it's the climate, whatever movement women are in, if it doesn't have women in the title, and even sometimes if it does, or even if it has feminism in the title, it manages to center men. And that is just something that I'm just not happy to do. Whether I'm a heterosexual patriarchy trad wife, or just simply somebody taking a coin from the Heritage Foundation, neither of which are true. But even if it was, I think it's just fundamental that we are allowed to say that women are enough, and we are allowed to center women without caveats, without explanation, and without asking for permission. So I do believe that's something that we do here at Standing for Women. And I think that's something that I do, because I rarely ask permission for anyone, from anyone for anything. So moving forward, we do Speaker's Corner at the last Sunday of every month. And then mid-month, we try and go to somewhere completely different, where we know that for some women, it's just simply not affordable, both time-wise or financially, to come to London. And so we will, these are the cities that we're doing. 18th of September is, we've already got 300 women committed to come into the event in Brighton. The more the merrier. We know the trans activists will come. We practically extend a very warm invite to each and every one of them. But you women, you have to come. We'll also be seeing Newcastle, Plymouth, Cardiff and Birmingham are some other cities that we are planning. But if you want a voice and you feel that it's very difficult to get one and nobody is listening, then I promise you at Standing for Women, we will offer you the microphone. We will offer you our YouTube audience. But you are more than welcome, each and every woman, whether you're on the right or the left or somewhere in between, or you really can't be arsed with politics at all.
How do you keep going? And also, where do you get your ideas from? You said a little bit from you've got some ideas from a few other women, Julia Long and Sheila Jeffries and the woman on Mumsnet. But where do you work out your ideas? Because you're so creative.
Well, I think that's the thing is, Joe, I don't really work them out. I just think I can do them. And I'm not always right, but I will just do it. Even when I was a little kid, you know, it's just like if my bike had a puncture, I thought I could fix it. And then I just find out a way to do it. So it really is just might be a stupidity. It might be an arrogance or just being plain obnoxious. But I sort of think, well, if I think it's a good idea, then maybe it is a good idea and I'll just do it. The call-ins, I did have a friend who suggested it about a year ago and I just totally dismissed it out of hand. And then I did a talk radio thing and they said their phone lines had never been so busy. Brilliant. And so I thought, okay, well, let's do it then. But, you know, I'd suck it and see. It doesn't always work that well. My technical ability is not great. But it's just about, if I think it's a good idea, I'm just going to do it. And the fact that I work mostly on my own means that I don't have to run it by anybody who's then going to tell me all the reasons why I shouldn't do something.
Why weren't you invited to the J.K. Rowling lunch? I thought, like, I've got an answer for that, but tell us what you think.
Oh, I don't know. Why wouldn't I be? I mean, maybe it's because I haven't done enough. I don't know. I think I've been, look, I think it's called blotting your copybook. And I probably did that early on. I was probably a little less guarded and probably talked far too much about men in dresses as opposed to women and women's spaces. And so I might have made myself not appropriate for polite society. And it's something that I have really considered, because clearly what I want is I want as many people as possible to hear the words I'm saying, rather than be able to just dismiss me out of hand. So maybe that's why. And look, I've been very, badly defamed about the things that I have done, which I really, really haven't. And the things that I've said and what they might mean. I feel rather vindicated this week, quite sorrowfully, that obviously we now have the Telford grooming gang report, which I'm telling you, I cannot understand why more people aren't talking about it, to be quite honest. I think this, it's weird. And certainly some of the people that maybe are ingratiated into those sort of polite circles. And I know some of those women have even done work, but it's weird that there isn't more. You know, you'd think that would be all we were talking about, really. So I do feel that some of my comments regarding grooming gangs, or rather child rapists, men that gather together to rape children, as opposed to like a grooming gang, it just sounds like a little bit of a nice gathering of people. But, you know, I do feel that those accusations, they have now been put very much into their correct context. But I think that's why. I think if you listen to enough people, there's enough stuff said about me that seemed to have stuck. Somebody mentioned Northern Ireland. I really want to go to Northern Ireland. So we at Standing for Women have local groups, which are women who can use what I believe to be a relatively well recognizable sort of branding of Standing for Women, the adult human female dictionary definition, etc. Although it's not my definition, but I will take it, and I will certainly, you know, if somebody writes a book and says that I invented that definition, I'm happy with that lie. Standing for Women does this local thing, local at Standing for Women, if you want to make your own group. Our first group, one of our first big groups is Northern Ireland. And so, yes, I really do want to go there. Also, just to let everybody know, sorry to use this as an announcement, on the 31st of July, we've got The Economist coming to film as part of their Culture Wars documentary. They're going to come and film Speaker's Corner. So if you want to be involved in that, that would be great. As far as, I'm just going to return to those comments with Julia. It's absolutely essential that I understand, even if I do wear this makeup and I do dye my hair and I do all these things, it's absolutely fundamental that I understand that there is a reason that I do those things. I acknowledge that I do them not as part of some sort of free choice that I've made, but I understand that why I'm doing that. And I absolutely agree that, and I'm not speaking for anybody here, just myself, but you know, young women now, I caught a glimpse of, oh, the hell on earth that is Love Island. I don't even know how it's become a program, but you sort of catch a little glimpse of that and you think, by God, there needs to be some antidote to that, where girls are, you know, I know people in sexual health clinics who are seeing girls come in, and they are girls still, with bacterial infections, where they are stripping themselves of every single minute body, bit of body hair. And it's really frightening. So, it's really scary. That's why I think I may not have the courage to live by radical feminism. And I really, really don't. I think it probably does take an awful lot of courage to step out of our indoctrination. But I think it would be a crying shame if we didn't at least campaign to get radical feminism put into schools. So these, you know, they can get transgenderism into schools, right? We can even talk about kink in schools, apparently. That needs to go on the PSHE, but I think feminism, certainly radical feminism, would be a dirty word. So that is something that Standing for Women, we have talked about. I wouldn't be in charge of that. That would be ridiculous. But I certainly think that it would be a valuable campaign to get radical feminism into schools so that girls at least have a choice. But I won't wax lyrical about that because it would make me somewhat of a hypocrite. But yes, do come to the Speakers' Corners event. Do try and do your activism on your own. Don't wait for permission, women. You'll be waiting a mighty long time until someone tells you that what you have to say is valuable enough to take up some space in other people's heads. And I'm happy to say I seem to live rent-free in many a feminist head these days.